You may or may not know this, but tonight is the Academy Awards in Los Angeles, right? The motion picture industry struts its stuff with the famous and the not-so-famous and the want-to-be-famous. The really good actors, or at least the ones who are the best known, we call stars. And I got to thinking about that this week. Why do we call celebrities stars? And then I just happened to find an article in The Atlantic that appeared on Friday entitled, Why We Call Celebrities Stars. And apparently it goes back a long way. Ovid was a Roman poet who lived during the reign of Augustus. And he wrote about the human dream of metamorphosis, the idea that humans could be, or at least the desire that humans could be transformed into the shiny stuff of constellations. Chaucer actually picked up on this, who has one of his characters dream about being stellified, that is, turned into a star. And the writer of this Atlantic article says, the language of special people ablaze like stars is in part because we desire a connection between heaven and earth, the mundane and the celestial. Deep down, people seem to know that we need this and that the world is made for it. Denzel Washington and Viola Davis are nominated for Oscars tonight in a tremendous film. It's August Wilson's play set to film called Fences. And in an interview this week, Denzel was asked to describe his co-star in two words. He said, brilliant. Well, our scriptures are ablaze today, aren't they? In this final Sunday after the Epiphany, with a most strange yet beautiful event of the true connection between heaven and earth. Jesus Christ, in brilliant glory, transformed, transfigured, metamorphosed, you might say, shown to be who he really is, not a star shining in the heavens, but the sun, radiant with divinity among us, for us. You know, this is a different kind of story in the Gospels, isn't it? And it's important for us to acknowledge that maybe we don't have a category for it. It's something all the Gospels take up. The first three Gospels we have kind of more narrative, and although John doesn't narrate it, he declares, we have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only Son who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. It's the meaning of the transfiguration that's most vital, I believe. And that's not to set aside details or context and so on, but I think to be primarily concerned that we not rush to inappropriate conclusions like Peter did, but to seek to embrace the larger truths that it calls forward. Because this episode is more poetry than prose. It's a real event. I believe it's a real event. But it's an event for which our language is simply inadequate. We're also using a certain lens as we hear it today, because it's the final reading before Lent, the last Sunday after the Epiphany, which has been about declaring the identity of Jesus to those near and to those who are far away. We began this time of the church year by hearing at his baptism the voice of God affirming, this is my Son, the Beloved. With him I am well pleased. And on the mountain today, this is my Son, the Beloved. With him I am well pleased. Listen to him. These two divine speeches are bookends on a season of the church year that has called us to know him, to share him with others, and to take on the life of his kingdom now. We've spent time in the Sermon on the Mount, a lot of time actually, that sets forth certain ways for us to live. And we can only be drawn to live that way and be given the power to carry it out if what is said about Jesus is true. The scriptures and the order of the readings, and especially this episode on the mountain, compel us not to some kind of generic ethic of kindness and helpfulness, but to a clear and unique understanding of who Jesus is And that since he is who he is, we're able to follow him into the life of the kingdom, his kingdom. Really, it's about having a new worldview with Jesus at the center. Because the revelation on the mountain took into its panorama all of human history from beginning to end and all of the history of salvation. Moses the lawgiver is there. Elijah the prophet is there. The disciples, at some point to become apostles, if you can believe that, they're there with Jesus at the center. All that has come before points to fulfillment in him. All that would come after, that is the teaching of the apostles and the witness of the church, would point back to him and forward to his kingdom. He is greater than the law, greater than the prophets, greater than the apostles. He is God with us, no less than that. Augustine said of this, "The voice did not say, 'These are my beloved sons,' for only one is the son. Others are adopted." But it's a wonderful thing to be adopted, to be picked up and carried and loved and given a place in a family. Knowing who Jesus is helps us to know who we are, who we will be. And the disciples were given a glimpse of this, a taste of glory, a brilliant display of light and sound that dropped them to their knees in terror, basically. They thought they knew who Jesus was. They had a pretty clear idea. They'd been with him, right? Traveled with him, ate with him, slept under the stars with him. And although Peter declares in chapter 16, just before this, that Jesus is the Messiah, you get kind of a sense that he's mouthing words he doesn't really yet understand. On that mountain, the awareness is nudged forward. You might even say it's pushed. Jesus is the Son of God, and it was hidden in his incarnation, but not absent. And in this event, it's shown outwardly, like a curtain being drawn aside. Dale Bruner about this says that what Jesus was within was once made visible without. He goes on to say that the theological function of the transfiguration was to demonstrate to the disciples that the seemingly inauspicious history of Jesus always contained the divine dimension of the true Son of God. In other words, they were so familiar with Jesus, his presence, his patterns. They were so familiar with his humanness, in other words, that they were shocked and literally bowled over when they had a taste of his true being. But they needed it. And so do we. You know, it's interesting that theology in the West, and I'm meaning the kind of the Western hemisphere of the church, treats this as one event among many in the life of Jesus. But in the East, in the Orthodox tradition, the Transfiguration came to occupy a more central place in their belief and worship. And for that part of the Christian family, the Transfiguration, this episode, pervades all of their theology. It shapes all of their life. It's one of the reasons I think they have a vibrant spiritual practice around icons. Because of their understanding of the life of God shining in and through the material person of Jesus. And how that translucence might also be approached in prayer through spiritual images. So the disciples are told clearly in this moment who Jesus is. Not just who he would be, but who he is now. The Transfiguration is not only an epiphany for the disciples. It also points forward. It looks to the full coming of the kingdom when earth and the celestial are joined and time and space have no boundaries. You know, and this is a place where language and analysis sort of fail us, I think, or at least fail me, because it is an experience, and the disciples are not sure how to respond. And Peter, who must always make a response, gets the wrong end of the stick. The forward piece is not only the now and future kingdom. The forward piece is also the cross and Christ's passion, which he must endure before his glorification. The experience of the Transfiguration is preparation for that, not only for the disciples, but I think for Jesus as well. You see, in a way, this is the exact opposite event of God turning his back on the Son. an experience that Jesus would have on the cross. It's the Father affirming fully their unity along with the Spirit. It's God's words of love and certainty about Jesus, his unique Son, are heard not only by the disciples, but they're heard by Jesus as well. And that experience calls him forward toward Jerusalem. There's a lesson in here for us, I believe, that we can too easily miss. Jesus leads these three disciples up the mountain, but when the smoke and lights have cleared, he leads them down again. Peter thinks they should just stay up there. Let's make it permanent, or more permanent, he suggests. But he has it wrong, because Jesus is not to be treated on the same par with Moses and Elijah, and besides, we can't live on that mountain. We must descend. To remain on the mountain was and is a temptation that can draw us away from the work that God really desires to do in us and through us. Jesus had a mission to fulfill on the cross. Staying on the mountain would have represented a rejection of that mission. Ephraim the Syrian, writing in the 4th century, said this: Jesus took them, Peter, James, and John, up the mountain that he might show them his kingdom before they witnessed his suffering and death, so that they might understand that he was not crucified because of his own powerlessness, but because it had pleased him of his goodness to suffer for the salvation of the world. Another early church father said that Peter's suggestion was not a wicked one. It was just inappropriate. He said this: among the temptations of this life, we should understand that we are to ask for endurance before glory. Good fortune in ruling cannot come before a time of enduring. Moses goes up the mountain, and Moses comes down again, and what he had to deal with wasn't pretty. Jesus and the disciples go up the mountain, but they come down again to walk the path toward Jerusalem and suffering. We cannot live on the mountain. It's a place of clarity and revelation and affirmation. It's a beautiful place, but it is for a purpose. And I'm speaking generally now of the common pursuit of mountaintop experiences in the Christian life. We can run after them. We can seek experiences that are actually not intended to be the day-to-day fare of walking with God in community over a long time. But there are those who run from place to place in that kind of frenzied desire for an experience that will keep them in kind of a spiritually pumped up place. And yeah, we should pursue God with all of our intention and all of our heart and all of our mind and will and so on. But it's usually a process over a long time shaped by consistency and commitment and humility, what Leo the Great called endurance before glory. I have known some mountaintop spiritual experiences in my life, and I've seen it in the life of others as well. But what I tend to see is they come along when they're particularly needed, in times of deep grief, in times of suffering or pain that is hard to express or get through or understand. That's when God, the Holy Spirit, sometimes comes to us with an experience of his light and his life and his glory that is sustaining for us. You know, some of the best-known revivals and awakenings that have happened in the history of the church have come either before or during a time of war or deep deprivation. In other words, it was a time of making people ready. God's preparatory work, an experience of metamorphosis offered to those about to undergo terrible suffering. This is God pouring out his love, even when we seem hell-bent on destruction. So if you're praying for awakening right now, just be aware of the context in which we often find them. I'm not saying that, that if you're in a particularly hard place, you will have some kind of revelatory experience of God. I'm not saying that. I can't offer that. Sometimes we just have to walk with God in the dark. But we don't get to choose. We're to seek the God of experience, not an experience of God. as Luther said. Sometimes when I pray with people that are really in deep distress and despair, the temptation is always for those who pray and pastors and so on to try to fix it, right? We'd like to fix it. I would. What I've learned to do when I'm in the place where I can't really see what this person's dealing with and things are cloudy, I just pray that they will have an experience of God that will be clarifying for them. An experience of God's presence, an experience of his healing, an experience of his love, an experience of his light ablaze in their lives. And I think if you're in that place, I would pray for that. If you don't, sometimes you get caught up in praying about details of things we're going through, hard things. I certainly can. But maybe to pray, Lord, let me have a vision of you that will help me to know how to go forward. Today we will come down the mountain and we will move swiftly into the wilderness, walking the way of Lent, headed for Holy Week, but also the resurrection. Paul picked up some of these themes in his letter that he wrote from prison to the church at Philippi. And in there, he quotes a hymn of the church about Christ's humility, that he humbled himself to the point of obedience to death on the cross. And then after that, God glorified him, giving him the name above every name. But he says this, it's very interesting. He says that if we will continue to work out our salvation, following the Lord without grumbling, without fault in a crooked and warped generation, then we will shine like stars in the sky as we hold firmly to the word of life, his life. Amen. May God bring this to our hearts today.